Our topic for this week of prayer is John of the Cross's spiritual canticle. However, for the first this evening and then tomorrow and the early part of the next day, I want to do some basic introductory considerations on the subject of prayer to prepare us for this very intimate journey. What is prayer? Now, Teresa of Avila speaks of prayer as an intimate sharing between friends, taking time frequently to be alone with the one who we know loves us. An intimate sharing, taking time frequently to be alone with the one who we know loves us. That's in life, her life. In her Way of Perfection, she writes, "Look at him. He never takes his eyes off you." John of the Cross reminds us that, quote, from the Maxims on Love, "The language which God hears best is silent love." Thérèse of Lisieux writes, "For me, prayer is a surge of the heart, a simple look turned towards heaven, a cry of recognition and of love, embracing both trial and joy. It unites me," she says in her Story of the Soul, "it unites me to Jesus." In a more lengthy way, the Metropolitan Anthony Bloom, Metropolitan of the Orthodox Church in London, in England, in a wonderful book called Courage to Pray, writes this: "Prayer is a search for God, encounter with God, and going beyond encounter, communion." So it's search, encounter, communion. "It arises," he writes, "from the awareness that the world in which we live is not simply two-dimensional, imprisoned in the categories of time and space, a flat world in which we meet only the surface of things, an opaque surface covering emptiness. Prayer is born of the discovery that the world has depths, that we're not only surrounded by visible things, but that we are also immersed in and penetrated by invisible things, and that this invisible world is both the presence of God, the supreme, sublime reality, and our own deepest truth. Living only in the visible world," he writes, "is living on the surface. It ignores or sets aside not only the existence of God, but the depths of created being. It's condemning ourselves to perceive only the world's surface." The human heart, he says, is deep. When we've reached the fountainhead of a human being's life, we discover that this itself springs from beyond. The human heart is open to the invisible, not the invisible of depth psychology, but the invisible infinite. God's creative word, God himself. Returning to ourselves is thus not a synonym for introversion, but for emerging beyond the limits of our limited selves. St. John Chrysostom said, "When you discover the door of your heart, you discover the gate of heaven." This discovery of our own depths goes together with the recognition of the depths in others. Each has his or her own immensity. The immensity of our vocation is to share the divine nature. And in discovering our own depths, we discover God. Oh, we've quoted some mystics, we've quoted Metropolitan Bloom. These are just some of my own thoughts now on the mysterious nature of prayer. See if it makes sense to you, because ultimately it's what you hear from inside that's important. I'll just give it my best shot, but you'll know if it makes sense to you. Prayer has its origin in the wonder of God's self-revelation, self-gift. For the initiative in prayer always comes from God. It's God who invites us into divine communion by revealing himself to us through his word, which we find in and through the world around us, and through his spirit, which we experience in and through the movements of our own soul. So in the biblical tradition, the word is used for God coming to you or me from outside in nature and events and history and people, especially the word made flesh, of course, Jesus. And we use the word spirit for that which is poured into our hearts. That's the gift ultimately of Jesus, prayer and consciousness and communion with God, love. So it's the inner and the outer. The outer is the word, the inner is the spirit. It's God who attracts us in both these ways to respond. And when we respond to God's gift of himself in word and spirit, we find ourselves engaged in prayer. Our experience of God is necessarily always an experience of a mysterious presence, inviting us to the heart of reality and so to our own heart. The more the closer we come to the heart, the more we find ourselves drawn beyond into mystery. The journey of prayer will never end, for it's a journey into the heart of God, and so into a beyond that we'll never fathom. Karl Rahner talks about heaven as being not a conclusion, but it's a liberation from the limits of this life and from sin, of course, into an eternal journey of continuous, ever-deepening discovery. For we are entering, discovering communion with the infinite God. God always remains in mystery, and we are unable to contain God. Our response, therefore, will always be mysterious and personal. Each person has his or her own way of responding to God's loving invitation. Each person has to find his or her own way of praying. You can't teach someone how they are to love. You can give advice and so on, but each one has to find his or her own unique way of loving. Similarly, we can give advice, we can learn, especially from the great mystics, John of the Cross included, but finally we have to find our own way of praying, the way God is offering us. Each person has to find his or her own way, since we cannot comprehend God's initiative. We cannot define or categorize what a person's response to God's initiative should be. Now to John of the Cross, who's the author of our writing. John of the Cross has been presented to us by the Church as a master, precisely in the area of his teaching on prayer. He insists that prayer, being communion with God, is always initiated by God. It's God's longing to be in communion with us. It's a gift of love from God. We're free to welcome the gift or to ignore it by being too busy to respond, too distracted, too preoccupied. Our role is to desire the communion that we're calling prayer, to make space for that communion, to remove obstacles to it. But it's essential that we know that we cannot initiate the prayer communion any more than we initiated our own coming into being, or our own continuance in existence, all of which is this moment-by-moment gift of the breathing forth of being from God. John of the Cross has an image of a spring welling up from the earth. Now, if the spring is cluttered with roots of trees and rock and whatever else might be in the road, the spring is down below the surface, but we don't see it. We might have to clear the spring, get rid of the debris. We can do that. Make space for it. But the spring that emerges is essentially a mysterious gift from God to us. Now, I'd like to just take the rest of this evening initially to look at some basic principles to be kept in mind as we reflect on prayer. Now, these principles, I've actually given expression to them in my book called Yielding to Love. It's in chapter 2 of that book. And the book itself, which is available should you want it, is not on the spiritual canticle, but some of these basic principles, well, all of them are actually expressed in that book more clearly than I will do with you now. But let's look at them. 8 principles that we need to keep in mind. You check it for yourself. But I've drawn these from John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila particularly, but others as well. First principle. Since prayer is loving communion with God, and since God is always the one to begin the communion, the best prayer is the prayer which God is offering now. Not the prayer we remember, not the prayer we wish we had, not the prayer in others that we admire, not the prayer that we learn about that the saints seem to enjoy. They're all good things to know about. But the best prayer is the communion that God is offering you and me now. The best prayer of the thief on the cross was, Jesus, remember me. The best prayer of Jesus on the cross was, my God, why have you abandoned me? An honest expression of being abandoned, but at the same time he said, my God, responding to this drawing of God for him in communion in the middle of that terrible agony and felt abandonment. So, if that's true, and I think it is, let's gratefully accept and treasure whatever communion God is offering you and me now. For God knows our present capacity to respond. We need to remember always that to turn to God is already to be in prayer. To want to pray is to pray. To want to be in communion is to be in communion, the communion that God is initiating and longing for us. Second principle. We must, and we've said this a couple of times already tonight, we must constantly remind ourselves that God is offering us this intimacy of communion. God wants it. The value or quality of our prayer is measured by the fruit which it produces in our lives. Our obedience, our detachment, our humility, and especially our love. Teresa writes, "It's in the effects and deeds following afterwards that one discerns the true value of prayer." The fourth principle. Whatever happens, Teresa tells us, we must not abandon prayer. If we do, and we might, and sometimes we do, she offers the only remedy: we must begin again. The fifth principle. We should not expect the journey to be one of simple progression. She writes, "There's no stage of prayer so sublime that it is not necessary often to return to the beginning." Teresa Lisieux said when she was dying of TB in a cold convent, sometimes all she could do was say the Our Father slowly with Jesus. Teresa of Avila said that for years the only way she could pray was to read, which would help stir her thoughts for prayer. So there's no stage so sublime that we haven't got to go to the simple prayer. Jesus said, if you don't become a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom. The sixth principle, it's essential to follow the advice of Teresa and set our eyes on Christ. She said this with great passion because her spiritual directors initially told her to go beyond the body, to go beyond the physical humanity of Jesus, to go into a kind of a mystical state where the mind is empty, the imagination is empty, there's nothing. She's gone into the emptiness of God, and she said that's terribly wrong. The revelation of God to us is in the humanity of Jesus, his eyes, his words, his deeds. So she kept saying with great conviction, set your eyes on Christ. Jesus will journey with us, leading us to a deeper knowledge of the true God, a knowledge that comes only through love. He will also lead us to a deeper knowledge of our real selves, for in Jesus we see what it means to be made in God's image and likeness. And because Adam, we won't see it in him. We won't see it in other people. We will a bit, but not very clearly. We're all made in God's image and likeness. But what's that mean? We only know by looking at Jesus. He's what we're made to be. That's an icon there of Jesus. It's a Russian icon. You can tell by the lettering there. And the text that's open in the hands of Christ that you can watch is ancient Slavonic, the first language of the Slav peoples, the first writing of it in the late 9th century by Cyril and Methodius. It's called Cyrillic. And in this text, which I don't know, of course, but I do know this text because someone told me, if you watch the eyes of Jesus there in the icon, they're large, they're looking at you. Mouth is small because he's not speaking to you. You can't hear him, but he's looking at you with love. Teresa says, look at him, he's always looking at you. He can't take his eyes off you. Well, you look at the eyes and I'll read you the text in English. Come to me, all you who labour and are overburdened, and I will give you rest. Learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your soul. Rest for your soul. Furthermore, by looking at Jesus, we see by comparison how sinful we are. Now, in Hebrew and in Greek, the biblical languages from which our culture is based, in both those languages, to sin means to miss the mark. So we'll leave aside for a moment personal responsibility, though it's important. We'll leave aside guilt, which is also has its place, and we'll just look at missing the mark. It may not be your fault, it may not be my fault, we may never have been shown how to do it. But the point is, whenever we miss the mark, whenever we want to love but fail, or whenever we hurt others, even if we didn't intend to, that's sin, because we're meant to not miss the mark, like Jesus, to always be in communion, to love, to connect, to be in that profound communion with God that allowed him to be in profound communion with others, even if they weren't in with him. Well, when we look at Jesus, we see, wow, how sinful we are. And this acts as a warning. It nurtures humility. It safeguards us from thinking that any value we have comes from ourselves. And it stops us from the folly of thinking we're better than anybody. If I think I'm better than any other person in the world, I'm very foolish. And I think perhaps we do sometimes, the way we talk about others or put them down or whatever it's... Looking at Jesus makes that something we recognize as wrong. By looking at Jesus reinforces our longing to gaze on God, the sole source of all our good. So there are two more basic principles. Seventh is, if we're serious about prayer, we must be resolute in turning away from sin, for it blocks out the light of God and opens our souls to darkness. We'll need a resolute will to detach ourselves from whatever is cluttering up our lives and holding us back. This will vary from person to person and according to each one's state of life. If we're serious about prayer, we must try to live virtuous lives in obedience to God's will as revealed to us through the ordinary means of God's providence. And finally, while there is some value in studying prayer, as it were, from the outside, we'll only truly be helped to the extent that we're praying. Without praying, we can learn what God is doing in people's lives. We can get some idea of the intimate communion to which God is inviting us. However, we can understand what other people tell us about prayer only to the extent that their words shed light on our own personal experience of praying. Therese says, Therese of Avila, as much as I desire to speak clearly about these matters of prayer, they will be really obscure for one who does not have experience. Now, it's against those background of those principles of prayer that I want to introduce you now to the topics that we'll take up in the next day and a half. Teresa writes in her Foundations, and it's absolutely basic, the highest perfection consists not in interior favours or in great raptures or in visions or in the spirit of prophecy, but in the bringing of our souls so closely into conformity with the will of God that as soon as we realise that God wills anything, we desire it ourselves with all our might. What a great statement. We'll read later, John of the Cross says, want only what God wants. Ignatius Loyola says the same. Francis de Sales says the same. In fact, every spiritual writer would agree with that. The highest perfection is to bring our souls so completely into conformity with the will of God that as soon as we realize that God wills anything, we desire it ourselves with all our might. And she goes on a bit later in the same chapter of Foundations, believe me, it's not length of time spent in prayer that brings a soul benefit. This is good for us to listen to as members of active religious orders, even if some of us are retired or whatever, we still belong to an order with a mission to be active. Believe me, it's not length of time spent in prayer that brings a soul benefit. When we spend our time in good works, pastoral care, whatever, it's a great help to us and a better and quicker preparation for the enkindling of our love than many hours of meditation. She concludes, everything must come from the hand of God. So if God is calling you or me to hours of meditation and contemplation, wonderful, go for it. But if God is calling me or you to answer the door, to meet these people, to be involved in the mission of the parish or whatever it might be, or the school or our communities, then go for that. Everything, she says, must come from the hand of God. There are three things, Teresa writes in The Way of Perfection, three things which are very important in helping us to preserve peace, both inward and outward. One of these is love for each other. The second is detachment from created things. The third, true humility, which is the most important of the three and embraces all the rest. So we've talked about obedience as basic, and now she talks about love, detachment, and humility. And those four virtues will be the topic of our next day of reflection and more. She goes on, and this is in The Way of Perfection, I cannot see how humility can exist without love, or love without humility. And it's impossible for these two virtues to exist save where there is great detachment from all created things. And now for some really important focuses on those three virtues. When she speaks of love, she's not talking about any kind of love which we might have for others. You might have a very loving temperament because your parents were just gorgeous, your mother was a saint, you've got a natural love about you, and everyone loves to have you in community because you've got that temperament. That's wonderful. But that's not the love she's talking about. She insists that the love which we offer is in response to grace and in obedience to God's inspiration. She wants us to be a vehicle of God's love. As John of the Cross says elsewhere, what's the good of doing one thing if God asks you for something else? So, your temperament, fine, wonderful, a gift. But the love, she says, is what love is God calling me to give? What love is God loving through me? Similarly with detachment. It's not for us to decide what we're to be detached from. That's in spite of whatever novice mistresses or novice masters or whoever may have tried to detach us from certain things. No. We're to attend to God's call and the many ways in which God reveals his will to us. Detachment is the response to God's call. In last Sunday's gospel, which was on the walking on the water, which we have to read symbolically, of course, metaphorically, Peter doesn't detach himself from the boat. It's a silly thing to do in the middle of the lake. He goes towards Jesus, and in going towards Jesus, he finds that he steps out of the boat, as it were. It happens. His interest is in going towards Jesus. And so it is with us. As we're called towards Jesus, yes, there'll be things we need to leave behind, to go, to follow, to answer, to respond. But we don't cut off what we think we should cut off, because we might end up cutting off that very quality which has got its shadow side, but it might be the very quality of our sanctity. It may be the very energy that the church needs or that our mission needs. And we may cut it off to be more docile or more whatever, quiet or more, inverted commas, humble or whatever it might be. So the key is to listen. Tell me, said Peter, if you call me, I'll come to you across the water. Our detachment is to be in response to God's love, God's call. Similarly with humility. True humility isn't discovered by looking down on ourselves, having a poor self-awareness or a poor self-image. No, true humility is the fruit of self-knowledge that comes from seeing ourselves as God sees us. And of course, he always sees something very beautiful. If we saw that, lived from that, that's true humility. Because it's not pretending. And finally, just for tonight's introduction, the quality of our prayer is in direct proportion to the quality of these virtues in our life. The discipline which we acquire in exercising these virtues prepares the ground, clears the ground for whatever gift of prayer God chooses to offer us. After reflecting on obedience, therefore, we're going to look in turn at love for others, detachment, and humility. Only after reflecting upon these four fundamental virtues will we be ready to listen to John of the Cross as he guides us in the commitment and discipline necessary for us to work at the kind of prayer response which we're able to make to God, God who is calling us into an intimate communion with himself.